If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Welcome to the Tryptophan Late in CU podcast, post-Thanksgiving, for Tuesday, December 3rd, 2019. That's Ian Ferguson.
Howdy.
Stuffing-filled Ian Ferguson. I'm Sweet Potato Pie Pat Contry. On the podcast, we'll be talking about Toys R Us making a return, Lincoln Mario Maker 2, and Atari VCS update. We're all excited for that. Our graded game's a horrible investment. And more, and a Q&A, and a Patreon poll. Ian, how was your Thanksgiving, real quick?
It was fantastic. I made ham. I did a glaze with brown sugar.
Glazed ham.
Barrel-aged honey. That shit's good. It was honey that was aged in whiskey barrels. Super tasty.
You didn't tell me you're doing that.
Yep, I did. So I did that. I told you everything that I was doing.
No, you didn't mention the glazed ham.
I mentioned that. I probably mentioned it on the previous podcast.
Glazed ham is a fetish of mine. It would have stuck to me.
But yeah, I did ham, mashed potatoes, beans, etc. But
beans, greens, potatoes, tomatoes. You name it.
We spent most of the holiday actually playing Sega Saturn. While Vonnie owns many, many good games for the Sega Saturn, we played mostly movie-based games. We played Independence Day, we played Congo, we played Street Fighter, Congo. The movie, the game. I will say, shout out to Retrobit. We were using their new controllers. Those worked extremely well.
Saturn ones?
Yeah, the Saturn ones. They were really good controllers. We had broken them out just like, I think we had used them once before. So we put them through the paces. Nice. Congo's interesting. It's a first-person shooter. It has very, very poor depth of field. So luckily it has an onboard map, because most of the time when you're playing the game, you're just looking at the map and making sure you're moving through the trees the proper way.
Nice.
But yeah, that's what we did. It was fantastic. I normally don't eat that many carbs in a week or 2 weeks as I did in a day. So my body like rioted after that meal.
All right, Dr. Atkins.
It was crazy. It made me feel very, very slow for about 3 hours. I think that's what Thanksgiving does mostly to people.
The mashed potatoes and everything?
Yeah, I went all out on the mashed potatoes. Cream, butter, sour cream cheese.
Okay, that's not just carbs. That's just like, let's load this up to be the worst thing your body.
They were delicious,
digest.
Though.
Of course.
They were delicious.
But I mean, that's like
hey,
the...
I've been watching what I eat for like 3 months
now.
I was
trimmer.
Like, I've lost 21 pounds.
You're hitting the gym, aren't you?
Yes.
You don't ever go with me. I invite you to the gym. You don't want to go with me. You should try yoga. You know, build up the yoga booty. It's good. It's...
When Vonnie's at yoga on Mondays, when you're there, that's when I'm recording the Extra Napkins podcast.
What was your excuse the other 5 years not to go to yoga?
I don't know, but I have one now.
I have an excuse now, the last 2 months, but not before. So there, Pat. That's my Thanksgiving was. My Thanksgiving was okay. I spent it. With, believe it or not, my handyman invited me. It was nice. The average age of everyone was like 79. I'm not even joking.
How old's your handyman?
He's only 60, but his girlfriend's mom was there and others. So it's good to like share stories with people. Like the one old woman I helped make the gravy, and she explained how in the 70s she was like a cookbook writer. She would try, because she said like in the 70s, like there was no like South American cookbook in the U.S., so she made one. She went there.
Oh, that's
cool. She went to Turkey, and so she did, like, a Turkish cookbook, and, you know, did, like, travel stuff. And that's interesting. When you're in the 70s, you know, the publishing world, and I explained what I did, and at dinner, I really explained what I did, and then it was either the people were so old that they're pretending to know what I was talking about, or they just glazed over from all the information I was spewing out.
Like a ham.
Like a glazed ham. Their eyes were glazed over like a ham. But they were semi-interested, but it was interesting. There was one woman around my age who's a local actress, and at first I thought, Glenn, is this like a setup thing because she's the only person my age and I think she's single? But I was like, no, her mom was there. So I was like, okay. It wasn't like a sneaky like sitcom setup situation there. But it was fun though. And I didn't eat I try to eat like almost as much as I used to. I can almost do a plate and a half of stuff. And no, it's not. I can't do it anymore.
I can't even do a second plate anymore.
I forced the turkey was so delicious. I had to get a second plate of dark meat. Like I just had to. And the stuffing was good. Or dressing. It's dressing when it's inside the turkey. It's dressing.
I thought it was dressing when it's outside the turkey. Stuffing when it's in the turkey. Sense. Hence stuffing.
Well, the stuffing was good.
As I make a fisting motion.
There was option for dressing or stuffing, but you always go for the stuffing. It's always more moist and good. So other than that, what's going on? Lots of little things going on. New NES Punk video. We'll talk about more in detail lately. Two in a month. Wow. Check it out. It's AVGN versus Pat in Combat. The app is finally updated, and it's a little rocky on the Android side. I understand that right now. It has been for years. That's why we had to totally update it, because it was abandoned by the developer. So give it patience on the Android side. The iOS is a lot more stable. We're working through some bugs. The problem with Android, if you know that, is that there's a billion different phones and they all operate on different sort of platforms and they're different. iOS, it's all one interface and one platform to deal with, really. Technically, it's not on Android. So be patient. If you got the app and you update it, if there's huge problems, you can try deleting it and reinstalling it. Unfortunately, since now we're putting in cloud syncing function to backing up your data, your old data, if you update, unfortunately, will be lost in terms of your collection. But we really couldn't do anything about that because the app was never future-proofed. It was never in the past able to put on the features that it's now getting. So that was unfortunate. We tried to save the old data from people who said there's no way to possibly do it because it was stored locally to everyone. There's just no way to pull it back for there. So apologize to that. I can only go by what my app developers tell me what they do. I don't have full control over that, but if you want a refund, I think you can get it on Android. I think you can get your money back, I think, if it's that horrible. But we're updating it. So give it some time, please. Shout out to SideQuest Games, who not only are now carrying a certain Super Nintendo guidebook, gave me a decent deal on that giant Mario that Ian said, oh yeah, I had that. Mario.
I still do.
From 88, 89, yeah.
I'd never known where it came from. I assumed it was a bootleg.
Oh no, that's real. It's the same as the little guys right here, Ian.
And now that I think about it, I think I actually found that at like a Goodwill or something. But my friends and I always, specifically one friend and I, always referred to that as the Where's My Keys Mario. He looks very, very... Huh? Concerned.
What? I gotta get to work.
And we would sit down there in the basement den room with the games and stuff, and we'd sit there and we'd trip our balls off, and the stories we would spin. I walked in today and saw Where's My Keys Mario, and I immediately felt for the guy, because he's still, we're talking 20, 25 years later, still looking for his fucking keys. Look at him. Guys, this is all well and good. I'm happy to be here, but can you please tell me, where are my keys? I need to know where my keys are. My kids wife is worried. Like, I need to get home.
Like, the little one has a smile on his face, right? That's not a smile. That's like a concern, like, let's go.
Holy shit. I've been looking for this set of keys for 20 plus years. Where are they?
It's almost like he's trying to manage a party and everything's going wrong. That's the way I look at him.
Yeah.
So what happened to the nachos? I had the plate right there. Where are they?
Good to
see
you here.
Someone took the nachos.
I'm glad that you're not still trying to find them in my parents' basement.
Where is Bob? Bob was supposed to bring the ice.
Maybe.
Where is Bob?
Maybe your keys are here. So that's very neat.
So, but now I got to get the Luigi. So that Luigi be like, where's my wallet, Luigi? That's what to put the two together on that.
But, fucking this guy's going to be looking for his keys episode.
Always in the podcast and staring at Ian like Ian knows where they are.
Well, we have
Ian,
history.
You just had them in your hand. You went out to the car to get your coat. How did you lose the keys? It was a minute, Ian.
WMK Mario and I have history.
Not for resale, a video game store documentary. We are in the final throes of getting it on the Blu-ray for Indiegogo backers. Most people listening probably aren't an Indiegogo backer, but also to get it up on Amazon for video on demand to purchase or to rent, hopefully in December. And so that's going to be, you still have to see it. I still got to send you the Dropbox link. I owe you that, and also Alex to watch that. And then it's going to be good. We're just, there's a couple little glitchy things we have to just sort of smooth out, a couple audio things, and it'll be good. I'm finally, happy to get it out there.
Yeah.
Little glazed ham rumbling.
We were asked numerous times on the podcast during searching for topics this week about Black Friday. And figured we could touch on that real quick. Basically, the idea that Black Friday is diminishing, or it's over, or it's no longer a thing. And I agree. I agree wholeheartedly on that. You don't go out and do any Black Friday shopping.
I haven't done Black Friday in like 12, 13 years at least.
I don't think I ever have. But
I used to hear the stories of like the Best Buy near me in New Jersey. It was like people would get there at like literally 1 a.m.
Yeah.
Thursday.
People would camp out overnight. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think the peak of it was probably... So I first I'd say
late
yes.
Late 2000s?
It's definitely dropping. I would say the peak of it was probably 2010, 2011,
late
somewhere 2000,
in there. Something like that.
I know when I first started dating...
Doorbusters!
When I first started dating Vonnie, she would have to leave, you know, the Thanksgiving, whatever celebration we were doing, if she was, you know, eating with me, she'd have to leave at like 8 to go and get ready to like have things ready for the store, you know, because it's opening at 10 or it's opening at midnight or something crazy like that. You know, people with actual like tents and, you know, heaters and shit like that, you know, waiting in line. And we would do no business. Luna would do nothing because everyone would be at the big box stores. As time has gone on, I think especially in the past, like it's been very quick. I would say in the past like 3, 4, 5 years, it's severely dropped, and now it's basically nothing. I don't think comics and stuff, Vonnie's business, does anything particularly special. The malls don't seem to open as early as they used to. I know the malls used to open at like midnight, I think, some of them, for Black Friday.
Jesus Christ.
And now, you know, Vonnie went to work at a, you know, she was working a mall store on Black Friday this year, and it opened normal time, I think, maybe a little bit earlier, like 7 or 8. So it was earlier, but it's not as bad as it used to be. And I think the surest sign that Black Friday is changing from what it used to be is Luna. We've actually been doing business. We've seen business increase over the past 5 years. I think less people are going to the big box stores. I think a lot of people still try to do holiday shopping, but there's less of a focus on, you know, waiting in line and getting, you know, like you said, the doorbuster deal. And Cyber Monday and online shopping, I think, have everything to do with that.
Cyber Monday, here's an article that I just saw. This is going to be a main topic, but I think it's important. Was it 9.4 billion it did yesterday?
Yeah.
In the U.S., $9.4 billion in online sales.
As online shopping...
That doesn't count the weekend. There's always stuff going on throughout the weekend, too.
As online shopping becomes more of the norm, and as people are more and more get more and more comfortable with it, there's no reason for anyone to ruin their holiday, go out early in the morning, most places in the U.S., a lot of places in the U.S., in the freezing cold, and stand in line for a TV that you can get for the same price on Monday, sitting in your pajamas drinking tea.
Rush through against the hordes of people that will fucking elbow you in the face to save $20 on a toaster. That's what you're doing. Have you seen those videos?
Yes.
Literally door busting deals. People run through and trample each other to get money off. Now,
people have been killed. People have been killed.
I understand. I am of two minds. I understand that there's a lot of people that are less fortunate that this is their one time to buy presents to save money. I get that. But at this point in time, it's not as safe, from what I've seen, to do that. And it's not worth your time and effort to do that versus looking online. It definitely is not.
Or your livelihood. I mean, it's not worth your well-being, because there's so many other options now.
And it's now a sport. It's like a sport. When you see people running and like diving on the piles, it's a mob.
Yeah.
And it becomes like a sport. And it's sickening to see that happen, especially in this day and age with online sales. You can just do that and be safe and not have to worry about it, and just be safe, because it looks dangerous sometimes.
And it used to just be a Friday. And now, you know, and I think this is what, and I think
now it's on Thanksgiving.
And now I think retailers have realized that, you know, it's not healthy for their employees. It's not healthy for them. It's not good for anyone. It's less stress. Black Friday, when it used to strictly be a Friday, now it's oftentimes, well, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and also Thanksgiving if you want to go out, and Friday and Saturday and Sunday. And once you get to Sunday, well, you're rolling right into Cyber Monday. And I just got paid today. I'm going to take advantage of a Cyber Monday sale when I get home that's gone into Tuesday.
So, oh, yeah, there was a Disney Plus one.
So these sales just keep bleeding and getting longer. I'm going to go home and go shopping for music tracks on Beatport because the Cyber Weekend sale doesn't end until tonight at midnight. So there's,
so
there's
the extra day.
Yeah, there's really, it's not as imperative that you get it right then and there as it used to be. But you have some time.
But there's a lot that say you have to do the deal only on Monday. I get that. It's an imperative to to buy it. I totally get that. Yeah, there was even Disney Plus one. It was like $50 for the whole, 60 bucks or $5 a month for Disney Plus. I still don't think Disney Plus is worth it because I only want to see The Mandalorian. That's the only show I want to see on there. So I'm gonna
I don't think it's worth it yet either. I just don't have that. I don't have that kind of interest in I don't have that kind of interest in Disney properties as a whole. I don't rewatch Marvel movies. And
I do a little bit, but not there's only like four that are rewatchable to me.
I can wait on The Mandalorian.
Yeah. Wait on Baby Yoda. It's interesting how
he doesn't have a voice, does he?
Mandalorian?
No, Baby Yoda.
I don't think so. I just think it's funny that here I am thinking, I guess in my naivety, here's gonna be like a, you know, like a sort of grim, darker Mandalorian. You know, it's a grim, darker Star Wars, and we got to throw in a cute baby plush Yoda there.
It's A, not Yoda.
I know it's, yes, actually, man. I know it's not Yoda, but we don't know the name of the species that Yoda is.
And, I mean, I don't think he's actually that young.
He's 50.
Oh, okay.
That's young for, whatever species that is. There's only been Yoda and then the one female-looking Yoda in Phantom Menace that you never saw again. What the hell did they do to Yoda and Phantom Menace? That puppet was awful. It looked nothing like the puppet from the original trilogy. Anyway, that's why they changed it to CG later on. All I remember for Black Friday as a kid, it was just Midnight Madness sales. Remember Midnight Madness?
Yeah.
And it wasn't always after Thanksgiving. Sometimes I think they were like random days in December. But I remember my father, my uncle, going out and for Midnight Madness sales at like Tops. Remember Tops? Those were stores.
Tops in Buffalo is a supermarket, so I don't.
Okay, so Tops was electronic stores, semi-regional, New York, New Jersey. Could have been the first time I saw an NES set up sometime in 1986 was at Tops. I'm wondering, what the hell is that? But they'd had Midnight Madness sales. And they would do like, you know, get like a 12-inch color TV for like $100. And that was an insane deal. That was like a $250 thing, probably like an 85, 86, 80. You know what I mean? Like that was a great deal. So you go out to there and they probably have like only 5 or 10 of them to get you through the door. So stuff like that my dad would try to get. You know, things like that. Those are the kind of deals. So 12-inch TVs, whatever. 16-inch, the smaller, even the smaller ones, they were still expensive when we were kids.
Right.
And that was it. But it wasn't go on Thanksgiving to shop. That was never a thing. It was like, well, okay, stores open at 7 a.m. at JCPenney on Friday. You know, that's basically what it used to be. But I don't remember my parents dragging me around for a lot of that stuff. I don't remember that specifically. Maybe Sears. I'm not sure. All right. So Ian, we've got a YouTube topic. YouTube is lightening restrictions on video game content. And we're still in the intro. We're going to talk about this briefly. So a policy update aims to better reflect difference between real world and simulated violence. So there was a change that happened a while back where they will start to age gate videos and restrict ads if you were showing like, you know, playing Doom.
Right.
Or Call of Duty or things like that. And it was basically being treated like it was real life violence. And that, of course, hurt people that were, you know, gaming YouTubers. And people that there's some people that focus mainly on one game like Call of Duty, and it could hurt them. So fortunately, YouTube gaming has lightened its restrictions. So now, future gaming uploads that include scripted or simulated violence may be approved instead of being age restricted. There will be fewer restrictions for violence in gaming, but this policy will still maintain our high bar to protect audiences from real world violence. We may still age restrict content if violent or gory imagery is the sole focus of the video. For instance, if the video focuses entirely on the most graphically violent part of the video game.
So if it's a video that's all the fatalities from Mortal Kombat.
Or glorious kills in game, you know. So when you know it's you're driven there by the violent content versus the gameplay. Because, you know, I mean, violence is a part of first person shooters, but that's not like the main draw, I would say, to those videos. It's a video game. So it's good. This doesn't really affect me. I've never had a video age gated because of violence in a game, only because maybe I've gotten spanked by someone in a video. That's the only time something may have been community age gated. So it's just good, though, that, you know, YouTube is finally catching up. They're always like a year and a half behind making these moves. I don't know why they move so slowly. I don't know how the corporate structure acts, or if they care. It's a very strange company when you see these things happen, not to get in front of these things more sooner, or even just to catch up. There. So, any thoughts on it, Ian? You know, it's good, because to me, video game violence is more like PG-13-ish. It's not like R.
Well, I mean, it depends on the game, obviously, but I'm just happy to see that it's going to be treated more like everything else.
Because if kids can go and play these games easily that are 13, 14, why can't they watch the video content on it?
Like, right, exactly. If there's violence in a T-rated shooter, then it should be accessible to the same people that it's sold to. There should be some uniformity across the board.
Sure. And then you want to talk about the Riot Games
lawsuit being settled? Yeah, I think it's important to...
Because we did talk about this in November.
Oh, yeah, we've talked about it a couple times. It's important to bring this up. We talked about it when the story first broke. We talked about the update, and I think we should at least mention this. Riot settles its lawsuit. It's going to pay every female employee since 2014 out of a $10 million fund based depending on position and length of time employed. So basically, the payout was reading from the Kotaku article. I believe this was updated by Cecilia D'Anastasio, who did the original article. Riot Games will pay out a huge $10 million proposed settlement collectively to every woman who has been employed by the company at any time over the last 5 years. The settlement is one of the largest in California history for a gender discrimination suit, says the plaintiff's lawyer. So basically, there was a huge expose about how women at Riot were disadvantaged. They were receiving less pay for the same positions between, male and female workers. This will...
It was also promotion things, I thought, too.
Promotions.
People being promoted above them that they thought weren't as qualified or...
Correct.
Yeah, that was the thing.
So it's good to see this. Some people who have worked there have said that Riot has definitely made strides to fix their wrongs. Other people say that it feels a little bit hollow because a lot of the people who caused the problems in the first place are still working there and received, apparently no repercussions. However, I do think it's good that the people who were paid unfairly are going to receive, the money that they deserved.
Was it
a step in the right direction?
Was it pay discrimination or just I thought it was the hiring and promotion.
Hiring,
which goes down to
pay
as well.
It also clearly says pay discrimination here as well.
Okay.
And the money will be determined by their tenure length and status.
Okay. I don't see that in the article, Ian, but okay, I'll trust you on it. I think it's interesting this stuff still happens just because of the potential of lawsuits and just the fact that it hurts your company not hiring and promoting the best people for positions. Maybe I'm being naive in saying that and, my egalitarian mindset, but there's no way you run a company and want to be successful in not hiring and promoting the best people regardless of who they are. I just think that's insane that happens, where you'd rather have a potential bro culture versus making sure someone, the most competent person's in a position. I just think it's so silly.
By the way, it's right here at the end of the second paragraph.
Second paragraph?
Also describes how women at the League of Legends publisher were paid less than men in the same or a similar position.
Okay. Sure. Okay. That's interesting how that could even happen at a corporation where corporations, when they put out, we're hiring, it's usually a range. It says straight up, we pay between this and this for the position based upon experience and that. It's just so weird. I don't know. I guess the corporate culture I was in, I guess, was more stringent on this stuff, where it was by the book. This is how we do business. And I guess if it's a video game company, they think it's, oh, we're loose. We're, you know what I mean?
Well, that's exactly my guess. A video game company is likely not going to be run the same as whatever it was you were doing. That was not a video game company.
Market research. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I just think it's strange that this can happen. But they get, this is where they get bitten. They got to pay up. But fortunately, you know, the women for these positions, they move on. So the company loses the talent and people get a sour taste in their mouths, not a sore mouth.
Not a sour mouth.
Get a sour taste, and it's just you cannot run a company like this. You have to run a company cold and objective, and not favor a certain gender to promote positions because you want a certain bro culture. I mean, I just don't. Whatever. Maybe I'm naive when it comes to stuff, but I just think it's strange that this stuff can still happen like this. Like I said, it's a video game company. It's made. They think they're immune to that, or I don't know. Anyway, so that's all. So that's good, and good reporting from Cecilia, of course, who was on top of this for a while. She got an award. Did she get a journalism award? I saw.
She should have.
She's been doing good work. There. All right, we're gonna move into the main podcast talk.
I don't know what the point is between separating intro and stuff like this when like some of those segments are as long as.
I only talked about that for like 2-3 minutes. People like to have the long intro, you
know? Sure. Well, I don't know if I can talk about this for much longer, but Link is now in Mario Maker 2.
Out of nowhere!
Which is a pretty cool addition. So, Mario Maker 2 is getting its 2.0 update this week. They're adding some additional enemies, some new block types. But one of the big things is they're adding a Master Sword power-up that will turn Mario into Link. And so in the original Super Mario Maker, you could there was a mystery block that you could place. And the mystery block would, when you hit it, it would give you various costumes based on what amiibos you had scanned in.
Oh, nice.
So basically, almost every amiibo had a costume. So you could turn...
Really?
Yeah, almost every amiibo had a costume.
I didn't know that. It was a Pac-Man costume?
Yep. Almost all of the original amiibos did. I think all the Smash Brothers ones did. So you could scan, you'd be able to run around as all these different characters.
Little
you
Mac
could,
Mario?
Mega Man, Little Mac, all
How
of them.
How have I never seen that?
So it didn't give you any particular special powers. It would basically act as a super mushroom. So you'd get an additional hit. But they looked very neat. And the difference, so that for whatever reason, that capability was not carried over to Super Mario Maker 2, even though the Switch can scan amiibos. That, for whatever reason, that wasn't put in. Maybe it was licensing concerns, who knows, for some of the third-party ones. This Link, on the other hand, the cool thing about it, he does get special powers and capabilities. He'll be able to attack with his sword.
Well, it's Link!
Yeah. He'll be able to attack with his sword. Well, you could play as Link in the original. That's what I'm saying. In Super Mario Maker 1.
Oh, it's not just a costume. It changes the sprite.
Well, that would be a costume. Yes, it changes
the sprite. It's not a costume. You change the sprite entirely.
They called them different costumes. Okay. So it changes the sprite entirely.
Okay.
But they would act like Mario. In this, Link will be able to attack with his sword. He'll be able to do dash attacks. He'll be able to block, throw bombs, and shoot arrows in three directions to collect items. So not only is it cool to see, it's going to add so much more to Mario Maker in terms of how people... There's going to be a whole new reason for people to create very different sorts of levels.
It creates an entirely different game.
Yes.
The fact that you can attack with a sword and do things. You can create new obstacles and puzzles, and the speed running becomes different than just avoidance. You now have to attack everyone. And you're probably forced to do that. You know what I mean? Like, so that's...
People can design levels like that. So it'll only be usable in the Super Mario Brothers skin. I'm assuming one reason is the sprite is the original. And also, it doesn't have any of the other mechanics that were added later on.
Sure.
So it keeps things simpler.
Yeah, just run, jump, and you know...
Right.
Have a sword. I think it's brilliant that they did this.
So, it's cool. This is the second time they've really messed with, Link in shareable content The first was Link's Awakening, released on the Switch, the Game Boy game released on the Switch a few months back. That had a very rudimentary dungeon creator that you could use, and you could share levels between friends. This allows people even more ways to screw with Link. And as Pat and I have talked about before, this is maybe about as far as it's going to go with any sort of Zelda maker. But it's obvious they want to see how people take to creating things with Link around it. I think it would be hard to create, make a Zelda maker that let you obviously do a full...
Full game overworld.
I mean, honestly, the Mario Maker doesn't let you do it either. You can do levels, but as far as I know, unless it's being added an update here, you still can't string together worlds and make levels and make your own world.
I thought you can do that.
No, which would be maybe they've added it or changed it, but you haven't been able to do that. You've been able to play what's known as like the easy, medium, and hard modes, where it will pick, it'll give you like a basic map and it will just randomly pick levels for you, but you can't structure your own world layout, which would make a lot of sense. I think the only thing they could really do with a Zelda maker would be a dungeon maker with a...
Okay, there's an unofficial way you can make a world. Okay, it's unofficial.
Okay, yeah, so there's no official way to do
tool.
It.
Okay, you can string cores together through an online tool. Okay, it's unofficial. Yeah, I think this is cute. I think it's did we ever talk about that homebrew game that you can be like Mega Man or you could be Simon Belmont and just play through the original Super Mario? It was a ROM hack.
Yeah, I remember that. That sounds cool.
People have always clamored for. There's something about the original Super Mario Brothers Mushroom Kingdom that people just love the aesthetic and the fact that it's so simple and kitschy, and putting other characters in it, I think, is. Just, I don't know, it's a nice creation outlet for people. And Link, the way he looks and the way he moves fits into it, I guess. You can say even in a 2D way. You can say he fits. He looks like like he's a squat little guy like Mario, the original Link sprite. So it fits more so than Mega Man to me or anything else.
I think Mega Man would be a perfect fit. The original Mega Man is squat as hell too.
But the scale is not the same to me. But anyway, either way, I'm glad they did this, and this actually makes me interested in playing this because I love the original Legend of Zelda here. So no, this is going to be very interesting seeing people how people come up with different ideas of putting him in here because there's a lot more, you know, the fact that you can throw bombs and use the arrows to solve problems, that's interesting to me. It'll be a different type. It won't be speedrunning, will be different. You can still be able to speedrun, but it'll be different, definitely, obviously, versus Mario. So that's happy. But yeah, a regular Legend of Zelda maker, when I spoke out with Ian on the phone, it's kind of tough just because people like seeing other people go through these courses and get through them or fail. And with a Legend of Zelda, it's much more open than a linear course versus going through a dungeon, which a dungeon is more random. Item drops are randomized, and how enemies move and the patterns, it's slower than running through a course. So that's why they could do a Legend of Zelda maker. I just don't see it being viable or interesting to most people.
I think a dungeon maker would be interesting to a lot of people. I just don't know if they'll actually do it.
I don't know, because there's just less community. It's not easy and quick to get through that you can share.
Sure. There is something to be said about, yes, just try the course very quick.
Yeah, that's just not the same thing. But all right, well, that's interesting. Ian, we got 7 minutes out of that. Is that long enough for you for a topic?
It is, I'm just saying. I mean, we talked about Black Friday just as long.
Why is it, but that's not, you don't know SEO on YouTube, Ian. That would get like 2 views.
I'm just saying, it's a topic.
Yes, we put different topics in the intro. That's what we've been doing for the past year.
I know, I'm just saying, usually it's because they're short ones. That one was a longer one. I'm just saying, the differentiation between intro and, okay, now the regular podcast starts is silly. This is not an attack at you.
Attacking the podcast structure. I feel attacked.
I just think it's arbitrary.
Yes, okay. Well, at the end of this segment, it's going to be arbitrary. We cut it right about here.
Moving on. We're talking about the Atari VCS again. The Atari VCS. There's some news here. So the first thing to mention about the Atari VCS is it has been delayed for Indiegogo backers. Does not look like it's going to be by months. They're saying weeks CEO, what's his name? Michael Arzt, says that basically, you know, they're talking about weeks, not months, and that hopefully backers will have their units in hand in January. So what this means is, yes, the VCS is coming out, and here it is. That's something that I think I've always said, was that it was definitely going to come out. But it's still a matter of what are we getting?
So this, remember, this was, this ended June 2018, the Indiegogo, and it was supposed to be fulfilled. When was the original fulfillment supposed to be?
March, like late spring, early summer 2019.
So, okay, so we're like 9 months behind by now. And they delayed it because they said they got the new chip. People called them out on that. Some people said it was bullshit with the new chip. Remember that? That was like, what, April or whatever it was. So, okay, so they did our favorite way to get out news. They did a Medium article.
Yes.
We love the Medium article. We love the white papers that they put out.
Well, and then don't forget they said that they got the board. The board was ready in fall after a whole summer of no update. We covered this fairly recently.
Oh, we did?
Yes.
I can't keep track anymore.
So now the board is ready, but they're using a... AMD Ryzen 1000 series SoC system on a chip. So the fact that the board is ready, I don't know a whole lot about this, and I'm not going to pretend I do, but a system on a chip, that seems to tell me that their board is basically an off-the-shelf part, or less.
They're not doing it from scratch.
Yeah.
Small operation, Atari. They're not in Sunnyvale making this stuff in a factory.
So the Q&A goes through a few things, talks about the, you know, the ship date, the delay, the reason why it was delayed for the AMD Ryzen chip. Where do you stand today with hardware and manufacturing? The first units of the Atari VCS, they show pictures of the pre-production units that have rolled off the assembly line.
And that's the black one, not the one that Ian's going to slap his dick on.
Right. Well, I think it was either of them. I just don't think it's
I see the picture of the red one, the red and black one.
That's the back of it. I think the back of most of them are like...
Oh, they are?
Yeah, it doesn't show the front. Oddly, it doesn't show the front. There, as a matter of fact, it's very careful to not show the front of any of these. I wonder why.
Very interesting, Ian.
Probably because that's where they put the... Either it gets like the wood grain thing, or
plastic.
It gets a black one or whatever.
Sure.
And that's
the same thing.
That's what magically differentiates.
Well, they showed the workers in China slapping them together, starting to construct them.
Yeah. So they don't expect there to be any further delays. Can you share your communication plans for the next few months? I thought this response was interesting. That's a good and important question. We always want our backers, fans, and customers to know how much they matter to us, and we want them to remain informed. Yeah. We understand that all of our stakeholders would like to know where things stand every day and want immediate answers to their individual posts and messages. I respectfully ask them to please understand that as a public company, we must follow specific protocols that are in place. In addition, because we also must consider the needs and wishes of our various partners, we do not always have full control over the pace or timing of our communications.
What?
We aim to make periodic updates to our community with complete transparency. If there's one thing I'd want people to always know, it's that no news is good news where the Atari VCS is concerned.
Wow, okay. All right, Michael.
Yeah, I don't think a lack of communication.
Did they just bring Michael on recently?
Yeah. No, I don't know.
Did the French guys just hire him recently?
I don't know.
Because if Michael was paying attention, the no news is good news... That's not good when it's a project that people don't know what the hell's going on and you haven't done squat before ever.
Yeah, keeping people in the dark is
that's awful thing to say.
Yeah, that's a horrible take. And it makes things seem very questionable, especially when like updates were promised at some point over the summer and there was nothing. And then they come back and they're like, the board's ready. We have a new board.
What's this about? We are a public company. Two guys own this thing, I thought. What do you mean it's a public company? They're not a NASDAQ?
No, I'm pretty sure they are.
Are they on NASDAQ now? Oh, that's how they got their money. That's right.
They're a public company.
They raise their money. That's right. Yes. Well, here's the point. Even if you're a public company, it doesn't mean you're a public company has to communicate more openly to shareholders and to people or to make sure that things are going smoothly.
Sure.
So that doesn't make any sense.
They talk about how there's been, you know, basically vigorous debate in social media about the Atari VCS. Basically, people calling it a, you know, what is this?
This is a penny stock either way.
Yeah, but they are public. There's been vigorous debate in social media about the Atari VCS. What do you make of it? Michael Arst, the Atari brand generates a lot of passion. I don't know that it actually does anymore. I think the bigger concern and why people are debating is, who is this for? What is it going to do? What are people going to be able to do with this? There's a question about, will it have original games, native apps, or a browser experience? He goes on to say, yes, they will. But then a question is asked again. One recent report claims that there will be no native apps at launch and that all services such as Netflix will be accessible through a Chrome-style browser. This is important. The answer is important here. As I already mentioned, the primary way to access games and services will be through the proprietary Atari VCS interface and App Store. For example, if a service such as Netflix is not available... That doesn't make any sense. So he says that the primary way to do it is through the interface and App Store. However, for example, if a service such as Netflix is not available as an app on our platform at launch, it can still be accessed through the web browser in the sandbox mode, really allows unlimited possibility to reach anything on the web. We don't expect the pre-launch version shipping to our Indiegogo backers to have a full complement of native third-party apps. I'm reading that as no native third-party apps.
Okay.
Because he's not giving examples of any that will be shipping with it. There will be games to play and things to do. Okay, good. But the first big wave of apps isn't likely to come before quarter one of next year as we build towards our full retail launch and see a ramp-up of the installed base. Much of this is obviously dependent on the app development timelines and contributions of any developers looking to make their apps available on the Atari VCS. Isn't that something you probably should have freaking coordinated for the release of the system? I mean, you would think that that's something that would have been, I don't know, a very key part of the release. Saying, oh, it just depends on when they're done. Other companies that do this coordinate with their developers to make sure that there are launch apps, that there are things available at launch, that there are launch games, that things are ready to go.
Well, they obviously,
I mean, it's not, you don't have to read between any lines here. This is very much a, we have no idea what's going to be on this system at launch. I have a feeling that the Indiegogo backers are going to get it, and there's not going to be anything.
So Atari as a public company, this version of it happened September 2017, according to what I'm looking at. I can't find it before that. So when they took it over, I guess the it's Atari SA. SA is a French designation, I believe, for a company. And so they went live late 2017 in preparation of this, probably, most likely. So, and that's where the money came from, I think, initially. And according to this, it was a 43-cent stock. Now it's a 36-cent stock. So it's not worth anything. I don't know where their money's coming from. Just from this original stock offering.
Oh, Indiegogo? It was.
I mean, I'm looking at the financials here.
I mean, they got plenty of money through that. So Atari's, the last thing he says in regards to the apps, Atari's goal is to have the content providers that our community values the most be accessible via apps. And the team expects the volume of content available will grow over time as more Atari VCS units sell into the market and we expand our gaming and entertainment partnerships. Articles that suggest otherwise are inaccurate. So we're going to sell a bunch of these and we're just going to... Because we're going to sell a bunch of these, people are going to want to make stuff for it, is their answer. It's never worked that way before. People buy something because of what's available on it. People don't buy something because they love Atari and then wait to see what apps come of it afterwards. That's a horrible business decision.
But that's how their Indiegogo video was pitched. I mean, their Indiegogo video was pitched as, oh, I loved Atari.
Oh, I get it. But that's not how it's going to work in real life.
Not 40 years later.
The people who love Atari, who bought this because they adore Atari, and I'm sure that there are some of them, are going to get it, hook it up, see nothing, and they're going to put it away. They're not going to keep it hooked up and be like, I can't wait until 6 months from now when all these people see the potential of the Atari VCS and start making apps for it. That's absurd.
Why can't I find when the stock came into existence? I think it might have been earlier 2017. I can't find it on here. Either way, this is bad news. But good news, Ian, you can pre-order at GameStop.
Yes, and Walmart.
Power to the player. You can get the Atari VCS 800 Onyx All-in-System Bundle. Order it right now, Ian. Release date, March 31st. $380.
And please make sure you do that, because if you don't buy it, you won't show other developers that there's a market for Atari VCS, and there won't be anything for it.
$380.
They're telling you in this interview, this interview is saying, buy our product, trust us, there's going to be stuff later on.
The details page, the Atari VCS 800 Onyx all-in-one bundle, blah, 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 includes the base as well as a classic joystick and modern controller. It comes with 8 gig of RAM. That's it. That is fully upgradable. And users will experience an ever-expanding Atari world of new games, classic and remastered favorites, streaming multimedia and personal apps, or can easily make their own. Can you imagine if Nintendo said, pre-order the Switch, you can make your own stuff on it? Right. How would that go over?
Right. And so $380 for what they're offering, that
media
is essentially
box.
Going
it's
to be...
It's a media box.
And they keep pushing the sandbox mode. Right. It's going to be a Linux hobbyist computer. Well, my question then is, I was looking at the AMD Ryzen chip that they're using, the SoC. And like I said, I don't know a lot about them, but I know that those are used by hobbyists to make hobby computers, Linux computers. And that chip is $150, I think, was what I saw it for. Then you buy your own RAM. Go find your own RAM. You can get it for you're paying a lot for something that you can do for what appears to be about $200, probably. You're paying for a $380 for a fancy shell. Use controllers that you already have.
Yeah, and a $50 one button joystick and a controller that's off the shelf that they just rebranded with like RAM.
They say that they've made that they've made modifications to the controller. But either way, it's still a basic controller. You have a controller that you can use at home. If this is something that is appealing to you for the hobbyist aspects of it, you already have half the stuff you need. Go buy an AMD Ryzen 1000 series SoC. Build your own. So it's coming, but I mean, it's going to launch, and looking at this, especially the attitude towards people will see the enthusiasm for the Atari VCS, and then they'll have to make products for it. No, that's not how it works. This is going to hit with a wet thud.
Okay, I'm trying to find the stock historical data. I'm having trouble. It is cute that on the name of the Atari SA stock is Pong F, or like Pong France. I think that's cute at least. But I'm trying to find where the stock has been historically, just for shits and giggles. I'm trying to see how far back it goes. I only see it going back to 2017, but somewhere else I said 2015. It hasn't been around for a huge amount of time, though, according to this. So anyway, I would not invest in Ataris. I'm going to be that idiot that has all the buttons and shit around that no one saw the stock crash come in 2008. Remember the guy, the bald guy, the money guy? Don't buy Atari stock. That's past recommendation right now. Mad Money. Jim Cramer, Mad Money. You know what I'm talking about.
I have no idea.
The guy with the suspenders?
Nope.
That runs around, does the show? Wow, okay.
I'm looking right now.
Anyway, so don't buy the Atari stock because I don't think that I'm shocked that Walmart would make this a pre-order available. But then again, they can let third-party people on their site anyway. But the fact that GameStop has it going on here, that they have a GameStop potential deal, I think is funny here. But I don't know if that means they're going to be fulfilling it or just acting as a drop ship sort of thing for Atari directly.
No, I have a feeling it's going to be stocked. It's just, it's not going to do anything.
Okay.
And when, I hope they've given the GameStop employees a little card, that says, when people ask, where are the games, where are the programs, say, please buy this, they are coming. Show the world your enthusiasm for the Atari VCS.
They're going to get a bunch of 58-year-olds walking into GameStop to buy the new Atari console.
I can't believe the balls of that. Yeah, wing and a prayer. Have faith in us. It's coming. There's going to be stuff for it. Oh, boy, oh, betcha.
The killer app is you out there. You can create your own things. All right, moving on here. Okay, I don't want to grow up. I'm a Toys R Us kid, Ian. Mm. There's a million toys at Toys R Us that I can play with. So Toys R Us, beloved Toys R Us, beloved Jersey company, I remember. They've come back with some mall offerings, some mall shops. They've done a couple. First store opened in New Jersey in Paramus. And then one in Houston opened up here. It opened the Wednesday before Thanksgiving at the Westfield Garden State Plaza Mall in Paramus. That's a big mall. I've never been there, but New Jersey's like the world's per capita largest, like the most amount of malls per people, I think, is Jersey. I think that might still be true. Anyway, so they went bankrupt. in 2017, as we know, and then sadly by like June 2018, early July, they were all closed, the stores. So they did the ribbon cutting ceremony, and it's now, you know, it's they're mall shops now, Ian. That's the play with Toys R Us. They're going to slowly try to build back up the brand after almost selling off everything and liquidating the trademark, even in the brand name. They kept it, and then they're trying to bring it back slowly with some mall stores, which I guess makes sense because mall space is probably the cheapest it's ever been, and obviously it's a lot easier just to sell certain things in a mall versus open up huge, gigantic stores that lay waste in the retail world now, and doing that. So I guess it's bittersweet just because, you know, it's glad to see it's still around as a brand, but obviously this is not what we had as Toys R Us, but it's nice to have it around. So I guess, I mean, it's better than it not being around. I'm sort of like confused.
No,
about what to think.
I have no love for a brand. I don't care if says Toys R Us. It doesn't give me any fucking jollies.
A lot of people does, though.
I think loving a brand is silly. It's not the original toy store that you went to, and I'm more pissed off that tons and tons of people lost their jobs, and now, surprise, Toys R Us is back. Feel good about Toys R Us. It all rings very, very hollow and shitty.
Okay. Versus it just disappearing forever?
I mean, there's room for another toy store, but it's preying on people's emotions. And it's a weird emotion to have in the first place.
Welcome to how brands work, Ian.
And I think it's gross. It's not like this is a magic new thing.
Do you have an iPhone?
I do.
Then you like the Apple brand.
No, I don't.
You do.
It was easy. It's what Vonnie bought me for Christmas.
No, you like the Apple brand. You're in with the brand now. No. I mean, that's how this works.
I have no love for the Apple brand.
Okay, then get an Android phone that costs, you know, a quarter of the price and does all the same exact stuff.
It's what Vonnie got me for Christmas.
I'm just saying that we haven't.
Are you upset because I dared besmirch the name Toys R Us that is not the same?
I don't
as
care.
It was?
I just think it's funny when you think I'm not in love with brands when they're all around you all the time.
No, I'm just saying I'm not going to feel good about a brand coming back. It doesn't do anything for me.
Well, there are a lot of people that are upset when it went away. Like Dan did a video about it celebrating with his son. Like
I understand
saying this
being upset that the toy store you knew went away. This is not the toy store you knew coming back.
Well, I'm
not insulted.
Yes, that's why I'm saying I'm struggling with it because if it comes back to something, then it's better than it not existing anymore, I guess. It's better than it not existing. That's what I'm saying.
I'd rather
you're saying you'd rather keep it dead and buried.
I'd rather it was just a different toy store. And I just think it's, like I said, I think it rings kind of shitty and hollow when everyone lost their jobs. Toys R Us is gone forever. It's back in a year.
A year and a half.
It was gone. It didn't even have it didn't even have a decade to sit for a minute. They just resurrected its dead ass immediately after it died.
It's not a movie franchise. It can come back whenever it wants. There's no waiting period. It has to come back, Ian. That's not how business works. We got to wait 10 years to come back.
Yes, we all have brands that we know. We all have brands that we like. I'm not upset with people for being upset that Toys R Us went away. I think that this is very hollow and very cheap.
So what would you prefer? It was called something else.
Yeah, just have a different toy store.
Okay.
Or
but you don't want the same people running it, or you want someone else to come up with an idea for a toy store?
I feel like if they are bringing it back, they should be rehiring old employees.
Well, that's another conversation entirely. And maybe they did. I don't know.
Okay. Toys R Us is back. Everyone loves Toys R Us.
It's two mall stores. They're never opening these gigantic warehouse-sized places that hire 70 people to work in one store. That's not happening again.
That's just not happening again. Seems kind of gross.
Okay.
It's gone for a year. A year.
Year and a half.
Year and a half, Pat. It could be gone for 2 years, and my statement would be the same.
So them trying to resurrect it, you got a problem with. Okay, I didn't expect you to be that strong about it. Them trying to resurrect the, you know.
I mean, go for it. I'll probably end up there. I don't feel anything about this.
Okay. You don't think kick shit on people that might feel good
about
it. I'm
not kicking shit on people. I don't get it.
You don't get that people are nostalgic for a toy store that most of their happiest childhood memories are centered around?
But
I'm saying that's where it comes from, though. That's
sure.
the thought.
My thinking is, I feel like the people who actually liked Toys R Us would be kind of upset that they're bringing back Toys R Us as some shell of its former self.
But that's the only option for this, though. I mean, it's never going to be a big box store ever again.
Sure.
It's just not happening.
I don't think...
It's this or nothing.
I don't think people are as... My take, and I could be wrong, I don't think people are as happy about this as you think they are.
I said I'm struggling with it myself, and maybe some people are happy about it, and they're going to show up there. People don't go to, I mean, I guess people still go to malls. They still exist. This mall they go to, because it's a giant Paramus one. People, I know people from New York come into New Jersey because it's lower sales tax, and they, so that's why I think the Paramus one does very well. It's not close from New York City. But I don't know. I don't go to malls anymore, so I don't know how mall stores do in general. And I don't know.
I would be interested in Dan's opinion, because when people were talking about Toys R Us coming back, like, almost immediately after it closed, he said, I remember in a Twitter thread, he was very wary of it.
Sure.
So, I
don't... don't think what people... Here's the thing. You know that... I'll talk about just in terms of the physical makeup. You know that it's going to be more focused on, I guess, seasonal items. I know they're going to sell. You know, here's your... I think they showed pictures. Here's, like, the Nintendo Switch section. Here's, like, this popular doll toy section. Here's that... But because they got to make money, obviously. This isn't going to be like KB, where KB was a mini Toys R Us. They have it as many things they could possibly throw into the store, you know, into like 7 or 8 aisles. And they had puzzles. They had video games. I don't think this is going to be it. This is going to be like, here's the stuff we know is going to sell. You know, here's the stuff that
sure.
You
and
know,
I think for any modern toy store, I think that that's a smart idea. Call it Toys R Us, or, you know, Jim Applecrack's Toys and Games.
Jim Applecrack's Toys and Games. Are you nostalgic for that, Ian?
That's a name I just pulled out of nowhere.
Jim Applecrack's Toys and Games. Did you see the Rocky Possum artwork?
Yes.
Okay, someone do Jim Applecrack's Toys and Games. Off Route 22 in Scott Place, New Jersey.
But
Jim Applecrack.
No, I don't think there's a market or a space for a toy store as big as Toys R Us used to be. I think it really would have to be a heavily rotated toy store.
Yes.
To the point where we only carry this certain toy when the new line is released for, say, a couple of weeks. Now, that's going to be tough, too, because it's not like there's stuff being released all the time. I'm sure toys just... I don't know toys in this way, but I'm sure just like video games and movies, there are seasons that are heavy on toy releases and seasons that are light on toy releases. I don't know what they would do during those off seasons.
Mark Callen, a marketing presser at Rutgers Business School, go Rutgers, said that Toys R Us is attempting to find a niche. They're creating an experiential type place, a place where they're inviting their former customers to come and experience toys, which is something that you can't do with traditional outlets or online. So yeah, did you see any of the pictures from inside?
Yes.
So yeah, you could like play the Switch.
Sure.
You could never do that in a toy. Toys R Us before video games were cold and grab the ticket and go to the check.
You were able to play games at a Toys R Us for quite some time.
Oh, I'm talking about from our childhood.
Okay, I'm just saying.
Cold and clinical.
Sure.
Grab the ticket. You go to the check cashing booth in the back and they grab it off the shelf.
Yeah.
Yeah, now in the past 20 years or 15 years, 20 years, it's been more like a Target or a Walmart where they have booths.
They've got
set
the
up.
Demo kiosks.
But they're trying to, that's their only play though, is to bring people into the shop and play it. I don't know how you can do that with toys though. I guess you have some toys you can play.
I do remember my Toys R Us had a TurboGrafx setup that you could play.
Oh, they had the kiosk that
The Air Zonk, and I remember my first experience.
They had an Air Zonk setup?
Yep. My first experience with Air Zonk was very, very poor, because the controller was broken and you couldn't move up. You could only move down. So I was trying to beat the level very strategically by only moving when I absolutely needed.
So we had the Laserdisc kiosk, but you couldn't play them. You could just watch it.
Oh, no, we could actually play it.
You can watch it, and then that was a running video. You couldn't even hit, like, the game to, like, with the Super Nintendo ones, you could, like, hit the game to demo. Mm. You couldn't do that with the TurboGrafx. It's just a VHS tape, which I own somewhere. You know, Spike Volleyball. You know that guy's voice. Anyway, all right. Yeah, I'm sorry I upset you. You know,
just, you didn't. I just I wasn't about to fall into the oh yay.
You don't have to do that, E. I'm not inviting you to jack off Jeffrey the Giraffe here. Like I said, I'm struggling myself. But it's either that or it goes belly up entirely. You know,
from a business standpoint, I get it. It's because it's only been gone for a year and a half. Not in a year, but not quite 2 years. But because it's only been gone for a year and a half, people still remember the name. There are thousands, if not millions, of people out there who are going to see this Toys R Us, and they're not going to say, oh, Toys R Us is back. They're going to say, oh, I haven't seen a Toys R Us in a while. I think there's a lot of people who aren't going to know why.
You deserve it for this segment.
You would do it regardless.
Yes,
I would. I think it hasn't been gone long enough, I think, for most people to realize that it was ever gone.
Okay, that's fair enough.
So it makes business sense because people are going to go, that's where I go to buy toys.
17 months it's been, Ian. It's been more than a year and a half. 17 months. It's a concept store. Jeffrey the Giraffe is walking around. LOL Surprise Dolls. Well, I don't know. That's a thing. It's a thing. LOL Surprise Dolls is on a shelf there. All right. Well, they're going to open more probably next year and see how they do and slowly integrate. I think it's nice to have a chain of toy stores and malls. Because what does our local malls have for toys? Do they have what do they have for toy stores?
I think there's a couple independent. There's an independent one, but nothing huge.
Nothing huge. Excuse me. Just like a little above mom and pop, basically.
Yeah.
All right. I wonder what they sell. Anyway. All right, moving on.
Yeah. Playmobil. All independent toy
that is
stores,
true.
All small toy stores
yep.
always have
right.
a hearty, hearty display of Playmobil.
When you go to like the Reading outlets or those like little, you know, you walk around, there's like stores set up here. What the hell are they called? Like Peddler's Village.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? The little village.
Tons
the
of
toy
Playmobil.
Stores always have Playmobil.
Always
probably
Playmobil.
Good margins on those Playmobil. They're easy to work with. I love Playmobil, by the way. Playmobil doesn't get any love. It's just Lego. I love Playmobil. Because you don't build as much with Playmobil. They're mostly just like you just put the guy on the horse. Sorry.
All right. Put the guy on the horse.
All right. Ian.
Pat.
We just did a segment on the show about Pawn Stars and WADA and the greatest Super Mario Brothers. There was a comment on our video from Reserved Investments. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I looked up the guy, and he's a guy who... He gives, he gives advice on YouTube about what you should watch out for, what you should invest in collectibles and other hobby fields. And he himself, I believe, he collects video game stuff, and I think also some, I think on his desk he had a Lego set, and then
he's got Magic the Gathering cards.
Yeah, so he dabbles in different stuff, and he's probably around our age, you know, so he likes that stuff. So he did a response video even for us about the WADA and their involvement in that Pawn Star segment. But then he did a different video it's titled Do Not Invest in Modern Era Factory Sealed Video Games. Why It Is a Horrible Investment. And we watched this video. And what did you think about this?
So what he goes through, I mean, he says what, and I think... And I'm not an investor. I'm not a speculator. I have no knowledge in this. But I
invest
think,
at your own risk. That's our disclaimer.
But I feel like what he said is a lot of very common sense things. I feel like when people get into collecting, I feel like there's a lot of shedding of common sense in pursuit of building up the market around something. So he tells a story about how he was buying a copy of Luigi's Mansion. He likes Luigi's Mansion. And when he was getting his copy, someone else wanted one too, and they asked the person who had opened the case to grab one for them. They handed it to him, and the person looks at it, obviously checking the seal, and then says, okay, now I'd like another copy, please. And they get another copy, and the guy mentions, you know, oh, you don't understand, I'm a collector. One's to open, one's to hold on to. So,
and the employee was like, what?
So he goes into why that's a particularly silly move. You know, one of the main reasons for it being silly when you're collecting modern games is the fact that lots of people have this magic idea. Now that they're going to collect these, they're going to buy these sealed games, and they're going to be worth something later on. Graded, ungraded, whatever. There's this notion that people are going to start doing this. I used to see it back in the day with the Atlus games that were released by Atlus. They were on the DS and PS2. They were generally released in smaller numbers. They were RPGs, and people noticed that old Atlus games were becoming worth something, so people would start buying a sealed copy and setting it aside to, you know, flip it for later. The thing is businesses are smart. Businesses want to make their money. They want to make that money. They don't want you to make that money later. So businesses like Atlus, they look at what they're selling and they go, we can sell more of this. So they increase the production numbers of what they're selling.
Yeah, because they don't make money off of the
right.
secondhand market.
They have no interest in keeping it collectible for you. They released small numbers because they were releasing games that were, you know, for niche genres. You know,
they knew they couldn't sell a ton of them.
But yeah. As the popularity goes, they would make more. So as people started buying these games, it also coincided with Atlus making more copies. So now you have games like Persona 4 and Persona 3 FES that people were speculating would be worth something in the future that you can still buy for between 20 and 30 bucks today. So he talks about how, you know, the basically that because everyone is doing this, there are, even if there was only 5% of every of the total amount of copies of Luigi's Mansion sold were kept sealed, you'd be looking at least 500,000 sealed copies. And even if that, I would say the number is probably maybe smaller, but I said, even if you go smaller, even if you say 2%, 200,000 sealed copies of something, what's it really worth?
It's a new entertainment product. It's worth what the retail value is, and that's what he was trying to impart to people.
Right.
You have to be careful about this stuff. And this goes back
and you have to be careful about seeing like a graded sealed copy go for say 80 or 100 because that's part of the speculation market. He could grade something and sell it immediately and maybe get a little bit more for it, but it's not going to be enough to really tell you that this thing is going to be worth anything in the future.
But it's either way, he says something that I've said before in a smarter way. I always said if you really want to invest, you know, put it in a 401k or an IRA or buy stocks because you're more likely to see an actual return on your money than buying new products. Because he said buy an index stock, which is safe. Get a small return over time, it's safe. You know, things like that. Because the price to grade games is not cheap. So you spend $60 on Luigi's Mansion 3. You go on WADA, I'm looking right now. For the standard no rush, which now takes up to 6 months, there's a backlog, it's $35 for sealed games. I guarantee you that does not include the return shipping or your shipping to there. Let's just say then shipping both ways is for a game, it's well packed, $15. We'll just say it costs you $50 total to get a game graded.
Sure.
Fair? I spent $60 plus tax, $65, $70, $120 invested into a game. That I'm hoping to make that back in 10, 20 years. How much do you really think you're going to make back on that game? If you can sell it.
Right.
Are you going to get a return or are you going to break even? That's what he's trying to say. It's a fool's errand. It absolutely is. Unless something is released to such a small quantity and you know the quantity. Like the, you know, like Nintendo putting out the Zelda special ones that were only in Nintendo New York, you know, for like there was like 500 made. You know they made 500 of them. You know that they're not going to be a ton out there. Yes, then maybe you could speculate on that. You can't speculate on new products like this. You just can't.
Well, and he also brings up something that's I think that's important to discuss that Vani talks about a lot. My wife talks about a lot when it comes to comic grading because she works in comics. So people who are out there buying this stuff now, sending it off for grading, let's say you do VGA, you get an 85. Let's say you do WADA and you get like a 9 to a 9.4. Those seem to be the, you know, new condition.
Out of the box.
On average, like out of a shipping box. That's generally what you're going to get. When you look at comics, especially when you look at now obviously there's exceptions to what I'm about to say for things that are truly limited or truly hard to find. But compare, you know, the grading of sealed modern games with, say, the grading and collecting of slabbed comics in the 90s and 2000s. Everyone started to do this. Everyone sends it in. People are sending them directly out of shipping containers or out of boxes. The majority of these are going to be 85 VGA graded. They're going to be 9.0s, 9.2s, 9.4s from WADA. That's not. So what happens is what you start looking for are 9.6s, 9.8s and above.
Ones that are gem mint where you can't see anything wrong at all. Basically.
Vani has always said, and it's true, and this is what this gentleman talked about too. 9.4, yeah, sure, that's a great condition in terms, like just objectively, it's a great condition item, but that is trash to collectors, to hardcore collectors. If you buy a Luigi's Mansion now, you get it graded. You get a 9.4. In 10, 15 years, if there is a market for that sealed game, the price difference between a 9.4 and a 9.6 is going to be huge. Because in a lot of these grading circles, the 9.6 is where it starts to become something desirable. 9.6 and above.
Like mint.
Right.
Mint.
9.4 and below. Sure, it's a 9.4, and that's very close to perfect. But to a collector, especially when you're looking at a sea of these games, potentially, or a sea of these graded, you know, Spider-Man number one, you know, sure. McFarlane,
yeah.
No one wants a 9.4 because there's shitloads of 9.4s out there. Yeah. A collector is going to look for that 9.6, that 9.8, that 10. And that's going to be even harder to come by. But what is that actually going to be worth? Is it worth you buying a bunch of these and trying to get that elusive 9.8? No, it's not, because you don't even know what it's going to be worth in the future.
And plus the cost to grade them.
Right. The amount of money you're going to put in for a potential return on a 10.0 graded, say, Luigi's Mansion 3.
Is insane. I guess there'll be collectors in the future that'll be looking at the seals and be like, oh, this seal's a 9.4. Like with comics, you can see imperfections a lot easier, I think, than on a seal on a... On a game, I guess.
I'm not going to say about something I don't know about. I imagine looking at seals just through work. I mean, you can see ones that are dinged or damaged. But
that's just it's we're talking about the condition of cellophane at that point.
Sure, and
that's what it is. If you think there's going to be people chasing that 20 years now, okay. The point is that to me that we saw baseball cards, and we saw comics, we saw mass produced entertainment mediums that people think that they're the smart ones, that they're going to cash in on it by saving it and putting it away and spending on it, when they don't realize that there's a million other people doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And the only things that are valuable are the things that are hard to come by that people want, not the things that are mass produced that you know, they're still kicking around in warehouses somewhere probably.
Right.
Or they can turn the printer back on anytime and make them. They can still make PS2 games if they freaking want to.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
a 1.0 Action Comics is still worth something because there's none of them around.
Yeah, I can't walk down the street and find one. They're not laying around somewhere in someone's back corner of their store. You know, like what these video games will always be.
So, yeah, he made
past new things being collectible 30 years from now. We are way past that point. Once you hit the late 80s, we're past that point.
There was some stuff in the 90s that became it too, but I think with every year that goes on, everyone starts to see dollar signs on things.
We're past it. People thought they'd make money off the fucking Star Trek Next Generation figures or the McFarlane Spawn figures. They're all worthless. They're worthless because everyone bought them thinking, I'm going to be rich 30 years from now buying a toy or a Beanie Baby. No. 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 It's not happening. I did the same thing too. I bought some comics in the 90s. I'm going to buy a second Daredevil Fall from Grace. They only made 20,000 of them. Yes, but everyone that bought every 20,000 still has them, and no one cares about them. You know, like, whatever they said, they claim they only made like 10,000 of them. They advertised that to get people to buy them.
Right.
Stupid little 13-year-old Pat didn't know any better. He spent his allowance money on it. Did I have an allowance when I was 13? I don't fucking know. Well, it couldn't have worked. Anyway. All right. Check out the videos. Did we cover most of it? But I loved how he said, like, straight up, invest in, like, if you want to invest in an index fund. You'll get probably a small return. You're not going to get a return on this shit. You just won't. And it doesn't account for inflation either, which people don't talk about. When you buy something to, whatever, the whole thing's weird. But I can picture, do you ever see people come in the store to buy an extra copy of something? Well, you don't sell a lot of the newer games anymore.
We don't sell a lot of new stuff anymore. But, I mean, when we did, like I said, there were people, like, we'd get in, like PS2 RPGs, and people would buy two of them, and, like, you know, some of those, we get those in sealed every once in a while, and I'm like, oh, I wonder if this is worth something. And it's like, no, you know, there were ones that had a moment, but then another thing that he doesn't really talk about, well, no, he does talk about it. He talks about it when you go into older stuff. We still don't have a great idea of what numbers are out there for certain things. And, he's talking about people, he's like, if you're well off, or if you're okay monetarily, finding a game that's worth $1,000 isn't the big deal that it is if you're in your 20s and you have less money. So he's like, there's potentially copies out there that people are holding on to that they're not talking about because they don't care. They don't need
that's
to talk about
we
it.
We always said that about retro games.
Well, and you look at Tim Atwood was a good example of that. No one, you know, there was rumors of it and murmurings, but that didn't become known to the public until recently. And that guy's been sitting on his collection forever.
It's not the only one.
You know, and then even with new stuff, it's even sillier because, you know, there was I'll use the example of a game like Shin Megami Tensei Nocturne for PS2. That game came out. It was
can't spell that.
It was desirable for a while. Sealed copies, even loose copies for a while, went for quite a bit of money, and they found a bunch of sealed copies, and they got put back out onto the market. And whether it was another print run or they found a bunch more sealed copies, they changed all that, and the price of that game went from being like a $100 game to a game that now sells for about
$20. $20 new.
Yeah.
You can buy.
Yep. So you don't know what's sitting out there in a warehouse. Like you said, you don't know when they can turn the printers back on. There's a difference between a first run.
Didn't they just do that for a Yakuza game a couple years ago?
Yeah, I have one. They reprinted one that was
7 years old.
They reprinted Yakuza 1, 2... I think they reprinted all of them, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Because I bought the first and second ones just because I was like, oh, here's my opportunity to own these games cheap. Yeah. But those were reprints. But sometimes, like I said, I think with the case of Nocturne, it was they just found more.
They just found them.
There's just a bunch more that they sent out.
Hey, Billy, we got a few boxes of this.
Yeah.
Anyway. And one other thing I'm going to say about this, check out his videos. Check out the other one. He did a video directly responding to the Pawn Stars segment. He straight out says, he's not mincing words, that, you know, since he's more into the, you know, antiques and collectibles communities, he says that there are people in those fields that are looking at what's going on,
yeah,
with these graded games, and they're giving it a very cautious look because of the practices that they see going on with the, you want to say, the inner everyone knowing each other and basically connected with each other. And so they're...
like I said last week, it's a very, very small world.
And people, they know that people are involved with each other. And so that means that the value of things obviously can be inflated and to be very cautious of it. And so that's why he says straight out, reserved investments guy, what's his name? We'll call him R.I. He says, definitely don't invest in new games, sealed games. And he says, I'm cautious about the old stuff even at this point because of these... we'll just say non-standard practices.
I feel like over time things will slowly standardize, but I would not be quick to rush into it.
Sure.
I mean,
you see where things settle out.
Yeah, everything is going to be collectible to some. Everything will have worth to someone. I don't think video game collecting is going to be a non-thing. I don't think in 20 years there's just not going to be any people interested in it. But I do think right now there is a bunch of hubbub about it because it benefits the people who want there to be a bunch of.
Yes.
Hubbub about it.
They're trying to inorganically grow it.
Right, exactly.
And that keeps people that are experts in other fields that might want to get into it, they'll stay away because they know that that the numbers don't line up to how many investors are in it and how many people are interested in it.
I think a lot of very serious investors are probably looking at it and they're like, we'll come back to this in 5 years.
Yeah, we'll see once this bullshit plays out and we'll see who's really buying the stuff and who really, you know what I mean? And plus, they don't know all the stuff that's even out there yet.
Sure.
You can't go and buy a bunch of sticker sealed black box games for a ton of money when you realize that tons of collectors are sitting on them. They can come on the market any time.
Right.
And that's basically what's happening. Those black box sticker sealed games are all on eBay now. It's like $500 for a Duck Hunt that's, you know, beat up that has a sticker seal on it. It's like, well, there's a lot of them out there, so it doesn't make any sense. All right. So yeah, check out Reserved Investments. All right. Ian, eBay came out with an article. We missed it. I think it was earlier. Basically, like the upcoming holiday wish list guide. You want to say that? And so eBay is pushing that the N64 is going to be a big seller this holiday season because year over year, there was a 205% increase on N64 consoles between last year and this year. And doing the pat math, that's a 4x amount. Of sales over the past year, so four times increase. So that's not something to sniff at when you see that happen within 1 year. And so when you look at the N64, which came out what 96 in North America, we are 23 years in. So when you think about the people that are wanting an N64 now, yeah, they're probably when they were kids, they're like 30 now.
Yeah,
or younger if they had say in the year 2000 or 99, you know, so they're in like their mid to late 20s or 30 or early 30s. So that's a proper sort of time frame, you know, to get back into it.
So I mean, just from what I see at the store. The N64 has always been popular, particularly around Christmas. I think I would say personally for us, maybe last year and this year, yeah, and the year before have all been big years for N64. 3 years ago, we went in December with I think a combined total of 53 N64 systems. They were all gone in 2 weeks.
2016.
I think that was about 2016.
20 years later.
Whoa. So I'm not surprised. The timing is a little bit different than I would have put it. I probably would have. I would have expected to see this about 2-3 years ago. But yeah, around Christmas, people want things that reconnect them with their childhood. If you grew up playing an N64, that's something that you're going to have a strong feeling towards. That's obviously going to be a hot holiday gift, and it's going to be a big seller. We can't keep them in stock. N64s are something that universally have pretty much been popular since I started working at Luna, but really in the past 5 years, had none of them at either location over Black Friday weekend. Within 2 hours of opening on Friday.
Oh wow!
We only had a couple, at both stores, but we were completely out of N64s.
I wonder if the swap meet, if those are worth more than a regular NES and Super Nintendo. I'd be curious to see what people are charging for them.
Well, it's
because I went to the swap meet, I was surprised. I saw like complete Super Nintendo for only like $40 with all the hookups by like a seller that knew it. I was like surprised that it was that cheap.
It's interesting to me to read this because like I say, I saw the spike 2-3 years ago.
Not your spike.
Not Cat Spike.
Not Evil Spike.
They say they're seeing it this year. Meanwhile, and I can't keep them in stock at Luna for 70. Meanwhile, my friend Eric is telling me that in Arizona, they will sit around at pawn shops and they can't sell for like 40.
Huh.
So it to me, it's interesting just to see like, you know, I think it's, you know, largely because of the holiday season they're seeing the increase, but it's interesting to see how these things can be popular in one state, not popular in another state, popular 3 years prior, and now very popular online. It's weird for me to see it. I don't know.
Well, I'm not sure where in Arizona you're talking about. We're in a big city, so maybe it's a population thing as well.
Sure,
maybe.
It could be.
They put out like a PDF sort of like wish list thing the same way. I didn't talk about this during our heated Toys R Us discussion, but I got the Amazon Play Together little like holiday guide, which
that
is basically
is
like
pathetic.
It's basically like, you know, you got the Sears, you just get the Sears toy catalog. This is basically the Amazon toy catalog, and so there's like one page on like Nintendo Switch, but the eBay one, they put out a PDF and they have Switch next to N64. As like the holiday sellers, because obviously there's used stuff on eBay. I just think it's interesting that this is our reality now. This was in the mail. They're sending this out to people to shop on eBay with a catalog, with the same sort of, like, you know, they have a little key in the bottom with the letters that lining up. You know, it's the same thing. This is why Toys R Us is only in a mall, partially, you know, Amazon. But okay. I just think it's interesting. They're selling 2 a minute, both Switches and N64s on eBay. That was in September. 2 a minute they were selling.
Jeez.
That was from the press release there. The guy suggests that Nintendo 64 could be a unique gift pick for nostalgic millennials, which actually presents a potential valid reason for its success on the site. Those who had an N64... Are you a millennial if you grew up with the N64? Those
yes.
who had late millennial. Those who had an Nintendo 64 as their first console will likely now be working full-time and dealing with adult life, potentially spending their hard-earned cash on reliving childhood memories. Yep. This very writer actually ended up buying 2 N64 consoles this year for that very reason, from this Nintendo Life article. I think that's cute. That's interesting. But that's where we're at. That's where we were at like 10 years ago. Remember, most people, the amount of time between when the Nintendo was popular, the NES was popular, and the N64 was only like 6 to 7 years. It wasn't a huge amount of time in between when the NES was on top of the world and the release of the N64. Not a huge amount of time.
I always have to check this, but millennials between 81 and 96.
Okay, so yes,
if you grew up playing it on 64, chances...
Yeah, you're the last millennials.
Yeah.
I always see millennials being... Because I'm born in 80, so I'm either the last of Gen X or the earliest millennial. I've seen both. I've seen 81, 82, or 80. It's like, I'm in there, you know, basically. I'm on the cutting edge. Ian's a millennial for sure, though. There. All right, that's interesting. So, yeah, well, I guess I got to go through... Actually, I think I sold most of my extra N64s over the years, with my DVD Kickstarters and things like that, I don't think I have a lot of spares left. I probably have like 3 or 4, but I have like the different color. I have the green one, I have the aqua one, you know, things like that. I sold my Pokemon Complete in Box one at SoCal a few years ago. All right, moving on. All right, Ian, we got a Patreon.
We do.
How do you access the CU Podcast Patreon?
You take your fingers and you type in patreon.com/CU Podcast. You go and you look at it, and we offer, well, I do a writing about once a week. We put up the full video podcast up there for patrons. I do a chat once a month. Yeah, so you can take a look at it and decide if you want to shell out some of those smackaroos.
Smackaroos?
Smackaroos.
The Jimmy Crack's Toys and... What was it? Jimmy Crack's Toys and
Jimmy Games. Jimmy Applecrack, I think.
Jimmy Applecrack Toys and Games.
Jimmy Applecrack's Toys and Games.
Route 22 in Scotch Plains, next to Bowcraft. All right, in third place on the Patreon poll, are the Marvel movies heading in the right direction, moving on from the A-heroes to lesser-known heroes? Only 7%. Black Widow trailer just came out. It looks interesting. I'm going to see Black Widow. Second place at 28%, Ian's pet topic. What licensed property would you want adapted to a pinball machine? And in first place, Ian, this has almost made the podcast before, not as a poll topic. What were the early days of flea markets like for game collecting? Put on your old man hat, straw hat. Get your corn pipe.
So it was interesting. I remember I used to go when I first started buying games for the Nintendo actively. And let's just say I collected from 98 to 2008. Let's use that, I guess, is the time span. I don't remember when I sold off the majority of my collection at too many games. We can say 15 years, I guess, 98 to 2012. I said it'd be 2013. Anyways, initially, games were not like super easy to come by at the flea market. You would have the occasional booth, you know, someone selling, you know, their system that they had there along with their other stuff. But eventually, I would say probably around 2000, it became very easy to find games, at least at my local flea market. The Nintendo stuff at that point, I guess it would make sense, would have been probably well circulated out of used video game stores at that point in time. So it would need a new home, a new place to be sold and resold, you know. And I think that's when a lot of these people started buying out perhaps lots of big Nintendo games, because all of a sudden I started seeing booths that would used to have a couple, you know, a few games, would start having boxes and boxes of them. Namely, the one guy that I used to buy from all the time, he would just have stacks and stacks of boxes, and I don't know if he was getting them on closeout deals or what, but they were all over. And it was still looked at as kind of weird at that point in time to have interest in these games.
It's like 99-ish?
99, yeah. 99, 2000. 98, 99, 2000. That would be like someone having an extreme hard-on for the, I don't know, the Xbox 360 or the PS3 right now. There are lots of people who love playing those systems. You can get a lot of games for cheap, but it's still, you don't see a lot of that. You see a lot, most people who are collecting are either buying for something a little bit older.
More than two generations back.
Yeah. Right now, I think GameCube, PS2, and Xbox are finally becoming kind of coming into their own, certainly by next year. So I guess that would have been what Nintendo would have been about then, because we would have been PlayStation. We would have been one out from Super Nintendo. Either way, I don't think video game collecting was really a thing at that point. It wasn't a hobby.
For some people. But, I mean, video game collecting had been a thing, obviously, in the 90s for people that were more on the Atari, because that was 20 years ago.
But that's the interesting thing. I used to be able to buy the Nintendo games, even, like, rare ones, would top out at maybe $50.
Yes.
You know, at that point in time, there were known rarities, there were known weird things.
Yeah, Funkoland had their newsletter.
The Panasian games were known to be, you know, at that point, they were going for maybe $150, $200.
If you could find them somewhere.
You could find them. You know, a copy of Stadium Events at that point was you know, $350 to $550. You know, it was still worth something back then. It was known to be very rare, but it, you know,
was
we're not
that much in the late 90s.
I would say probably $350 at least. It was a few hundred.
Funko Land, I think you could still order it for like $1 if you could find it, or $5.
Well, that's the thing. No one could.
Yeah.
So I know it was worth a few hundred at the very least. But what was interesting about that point in time was, you know, it was kind of cautionary too, because when I finally got there and was starting to buy this stuff, that's when the retailers that were selling games, the people at the flea market, were starting to put their Atari stuff out for next to nothing. And it took a lot less time, I guess. But you could see the value of Atari stuff going from something that used to be worth something to quickly becoming something that they just want to get rid of. But yeah, I mean, that so, and then as...
What do you... Okay, I'm sorry to cut you off. At your height, what do you think? Like, did you ever see, like, a Centipede cart for, like, $7, $8? $9?
I don't know that I ever saw Centipede at that.
Well, I mean, it's like a common Atari title that...
I would see some people trying to get $5 for some common Atari cartridges. Gotcha. $5, $6. But very quickly, that stuff became universally $3. We don't want to price it. Here's, you know, here's a bin for $1. Here, take all of this for, sure. You know,
it 15. Happened pretty quickly.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's mostly what I remember. By the time that, you know, collecting of this stuff really became popular, like you say, in 2007?
Six, I would say six.
2006. I had already more or less fallen off. I still bought games here and there, but I had stopped adding to my collection more or less by that point in time.
Okay. So I had about 3 or 4 flea markets I would go to in New Jersey. Meadowlands, which was decent. English Town, which was hit or miss because of the guy that with the store inside would always buy everything up at like 6 a.m. The one in South Jersey, Jesus Christ. God. The one down, I don't remember the names of these anymore. That one, and then there was a couple other ones I go to here and there. The one in Piscataway I went to. That was a nice one. Basically on like a dirt Little League field next to the firehouse. And those are the ones I go to. I go to like 4 or 5. I would go to at least one a week, sometimes 2 or 3. Sometimes you'd hit down the local one, and then you go to like English Town just for fun, you know. And that's what you do. You make it a day. You go to 2 of them. You know, it's like 5 hours of flea marketing fun. So I guess after I started collecting again, like 98, buying things here on eBay, I started going to flea markets. And then at the flea markets, you didn't, at least in 98, I don't think you had the guys yet, at least locally. You didn't have eBay sellers looking for sure. That didn't happen until the mid-2000s. That did not happen at all until, like, I want to say 2003 or 4. People started to really start doing the eBay thing and realize this stuff had some value to people. But it was like, yeah, you can go to English Town, and I think I probably talked about it before. You can, someone had a, you know, a bag of, you know, 20 NES games, 25 NES games, and it was $20. That, you know, it's like $1 each. Just buy them all. At that point, it's like, just buy them all, because you're losing money, not just taking them all. And don't even care if you pick up doubles. I mean, that's what happened. That was still in the phase where I probably had 350 games or so in like the year 2000, something like that. So I started to buy doubles even not knowing I didn't have the list yet. I didn't carry. I printed out a list. This is before smartphones and having apps. So I was just buy it all because it's cheap. And then maybe you get lucky and you find something that's worth $10. Didn't get any rare ones that way, that's for sure, because most people did not have games like that. They'd have, you know, Ghostbusters and have like TNC and things like that. And then, you know, so for me, it was more like you would buy a bunch of games, and it got to the point where it was just hard to find ones that weren't common at a flea market. You'd still see the same 50 to 70 games, we'll just say 50 games,
sure,
that most kids had there. You know, like you'll still see a Kid Icarus, and you'll see maybe you'll see a Donkey Kong. It's like, whoa, it's a Donkey Kong. It's a little bit more uncommon there, and that's how it was. But then it got to the point a little bit later where, like I said, you started seeing more people you knew that were buying for eBay, and then the stores that the sellers there that would buy everything before, and then it got tougher. But that wasn't until early 2000s. That was like I said, like 2002 or 3 and 4. It's when it started to get harder to find stuff because there was more competition there. Indoor flea markets, I think, are a little bit different because those are more like stores, the indoor flea markets. There was the one on Route 17 off of Route 1, where they had Route 17 flea market, where there was an indoor seller and he had hundreds of games, probably like you had a guy, probably the same thing. And the stuff was priced, I mean, it was still kind of based off eBay, but it was a little bit looser because it's like 2004, 2003. Trying to remember, like, you know, it was probably like you'd be shocked if a game was priced at like $10. You know, you'd be like, oh, that's kind of expensive for a game. You know, but most of it was like $2 or $3 each still for sure. A game. $3 each, or maybe 4 for $10, if I remember correctly. But even at that point in time, I wasn't trying to get every single game. It was just get stuff that's interesting or cheap that's interesting.
Right.
At that point in time. So yeah, that's how it was. It was you know, less competition, cheaper games. There was a lot of stuff that was out there, even though probably everything wasn't, because they're still in that phase where not everyone's aware that stuff is valuable, so there's still stuff that are still in people's closets. Nowadays, almost probably none of the NES, everyone knows that, you know, this stuff is probably worth money, so it's probably less and less this stuff comes out. You know, less and less of the, you know, Steam events, Yahoo auction stories that you see written up about, you know, oh, I have a Steam event. I'm sure it can happen. I'm sure it still does. I think a Steam event was found at an estate sale. Was that 3 years ago was found? But it's less and less as years go by, obviously, because people get rid of their stuff or sell it or throw it out, if that makes sense. So I wonder how different wonder my experiences were from yours at the flea markets. Probably somewhat similar, I guess. You know, did you buy lots of games for like $20? Did you see that?
Yeah.
I mean, that still happened when I first moved here in 2009 and 10. I still got some weird deals like that where it's a garbage bag with like an NES and an N64 and like 15 N64 games and a bunch of NES games for like $50.
A $20 bill is the magic ticket.
That was it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Flash a 20 at someone who's got a bag or a box of stuff that they don't want and it's yours. That's how it was back
up until then. Smartphones in 2012 when they started getting more popular. 2013, that's a cutoff. That was the magical cutoff when swap meets started being a little bit more work. And that's why, you know, like I was obsessed. I went every Saturday and Sunday when it came to San Diego for like the first 4 years almost. Yep. Not every Saturday and Sunday, but there was a lot. You know, most. I was calling Ian, finding the stuff, telling him about the stuff I was finding, asking if he wanted stuff. Every fucking week I was calling you up.
Yep, it was crazy.
And you weren't telling me to screw off because that's when you were nicer to me. Anyway, you had more patience then. All right, well, thanks for the Patreon question. Patreon.com/CU Podcast. We got a Q&A.
Yep, we've got one question for you. This is from Unnecessary Fan.
The completely unnecessary fan.
Is this a fucking plant?
No, it's not, Ian.
All right. Well, the unnecessary fan would like to know,
it's not a plant.
What was it like working with James Rolfe again for the combat video? Are there any other YouTubers you'd like to collaborate with or those you'd avoid?
I think that's a nice question. Those I'd like to avoid. Yeah, I want to start a bunch of beef with a bunch of YouTubers. When it comes to collaborations, I think what some creators not ignore but don't care about is, do styles actually mesh together to work together? You know, there's some people that just don't work well together because they have different styles of videos. Doesn't mean that they both don't do good content, either one, but they don't work well together. I work well with James because I think we have sort of similar sense of humor. But the story about this combat video just came out, Combat, that's on YouTube, was I had written a much more intensive script idea that me and James have been thinking about for a few years that... this is before Too Many Games 2018. So we shot that right after Too Many Games 2018. A year and a half ago, Ian, just like Toys R Us going out of business. About the same exact time, actually. It was. And so I had this idea that was too grandiose. And whenever I see James, like once a year, James is nice enough to say, like this year I shot the rental review for Predator. And then another one, I won't say what I shot for yet. And so he's nice enough to put aside a day to do it. So I got to write something we can shoot in a day, in like 6 hours. And so my idea was not something you can shoot in 6 hours. It would have taken like 2 or 3 days, probably. So I said, I can't waste his time. He's willing to do a video with me. He lets me write for the nerd character. I'm lucky enough to be able to do that. He allows me to do that. So literally the Sunday night at my parents after Too Many Games and that Monday, part of that Monday, I wrote the script to this comment video in about a day. And it came out well enough, and we shot it. And it's interesting because I'm not sure what it was. I think mainly James wanted to do it because it was a goofy throwaway line from the original NWC video, Combat. Mm-hmm. Remember that video?
Yes.
So it was originally an ad-lib thing we sort of came up with that it's expanded into its own thing and said, let's put an end cap on the whole Combat thing by doing a whole dumb video about it. And that's basically what happened. And I have to thank Yoshi Vu for doing the awesome effects on that video, just because those are Hollywood level effects. You just saw it.
Oh yeah, Major Combat is awesome.
Major Combat's adorable. We can sell figures of them probably too, unless Atari in France comes after us. It came out. It just came out. It came out better than I thought it would, just because how quickly we cobbled it together. The story, and we shot it, and then it sort of evolved after the fact in post-production, because I wrote Major Combat a different way at first, a little more by the book, and I said, why don't I make him a little wacky little guy, and it sort of works better. I think. And originally, Major Combat was supposed to be a giant robot. I said, doesn't make any sense. Combat's a little guy. So he'd be a cute little right. guy. Little Muppet-looking robot. And so that's how it came out. So I'm glad that the people are enjoying it. And the comments are like, this is great. This isn't a self-filleting topic, believe it or not. This is a reality topic about the fact that this video, for this video, in my mind, to do well versus the time and effort, and we'll just say mock money that went into it, this video has to do 1 million views at least for it to be, let's say, a viable YouTube content video. Because James wasn't paid to work on it. He did it as a favor for me. Obviously, I'm not paid to work, but I'm the creator. I'm going to have to. But the amount of work that Yoshi did for this video, if he asked for cash to do it, would have been thousands of dollars, probably.
Sure.
Would have been a couple grand for the amount of work he did for the not just the robot animations, but the comm balls and the hair and glasses shot, which was incredible to do that work. And so when you think about high-quality, well-produced content, YouTube's just not, unfortunately, it's not a platform where it's viable for most people anymore. It's not. And it's sort of not bittersweet, but when I do a video like this that was in the works for so long, partially because Yoshi had to have time to work on this CG, for God's sake, he's working on freaking Star Wars, and he's got to work on a dumb YouTube project on the side for me because I'm his friend. And I was thinking about, like, if I wanted to do something like this regularly or write something where people had input more than just me doing myself, I can't do it on YouTube. It just doesn't make any sense. The numbers don't add up.
Right.
It just doesn't. And I hope people appreciate, you know, the fact that like I marvel that these AVGN videos still go on 13 years later and they're more and more involved. Obviously, he has people helping them at ScreenWave, but most YouTube's not for this content anymore. It hasn't been for years.
Right. It's for quick, throw it up as fast as you can content.
So it's depressing that that's the reality, but it is. You can say it's, if you know, for content like that, you do a Kickstarter for it to do videos like that, so people actually get paid for their hard work. So like, because like Video Game Years was a cold reality check for a lot of us, because the amount of effort that went into it and money, and people were doing things in the cheap, we're like, oh, this is a great show. We could potentially do something like this on real TV. And then it goes on YouTube, and then it gets some views, but not enough to support the time, money, and effort that went into it. And it is what it is. But it's done well on Amazon Prime, and I think that's what the future, I think, will be for some YouTubers. Like, if I was going to do it at Path the Anius Punk actual series, like 6 to 8 episodes, I think I'd have to look other venues, whether it was Kickstarter or just put it on Amazon Prime, or just try to sell Blu-rays of it. If it was like, you know, I took 2 months to do 6 to 8 episodes, but you can't make the time money back on YouTube. You just can't.
Right.
And it's depressing. I mean, you're not in this world, but you know, it's just hard to do. Like even people that are doing great content, like Norm, he has a healthy Patreon to help him support those videos.
Sure.
The views on YouTube alone don't support, it just can't.
Right.
I mean, that's really what I want to talk about. So I'm glad everyone likes the video. Go and watch it. Ian didn't hate it.
I watched it.
I put in a little reference for you.
Yeah. What, Mappyland?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw.
So you get a little chuckle about that?
Yes, I did.
Maybe it'll be the Mappyland in the future. There. So yeah, NES Punk stuff will still be around here and there, but I really think that, yeah, I think the way YouTube works nowadays, where, you know, I'm not you know, complaining about The Last Jedi again. Those are videos that are easy to do and don't require other people to really help you usually. And you can get them out. You can rant about politics and get it out easily. You can rant about how Capcom screwed up. You can rant about SJWs ruining the world, and that can get views easily and it's easy to produce. But that's not content that I want to do, obviously, and that's not worthwhile content, I think, in the long run for people to want to watch and be around, you know. So, but that's what YouTube likes. So what are you going to do? You find the other platform. It's not like, it's not create something else to match the platform. You find the audience that likes your stuff. That's my philosophy, you know, and hopefully that'll continue in the future. So, all right.
Well, I'm off to go get blood drawn.
Okay, that's sexy as hell, Ian.
Yeah.
Then you go into Jimmy Crack Corns. What is it? Jimmy Crack.
Jimmy Apple Cracks.
Jimmy Apple Cracks. Jimmy Apple Cracks Toys and Games Emporium. That's funny. We'll do a little skit of that.
So, before we leave, I do want to say one thing that's pretty important. I really want people to take this a bit more seriously than they may be taking it now. But if anyone's seen Mario's fucking keys, let the guy know where they are. All right? Just keep him.
I just had him! Karen, I just had him!
Keep him posted. Give him a heads up if you find him. He's got to walk the dog.
Got to walk the dog? He's got to drive. He's got to drive the supermarket.
Something like that.
You can get out of your house if you have keys. You just can't lock the door, I guess. All right. That's Ian Ferguson. I'm Pat Contry. We will see you next week with more holiday fun.